This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, December 9th, 2009. From New York City, I'm Doreen Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, healthcare reform moves forward in the Senate, but without a public option.
It's really a ghost of its former self.
Developing nations press for alternative solutions at the climate conference in Copenhagen.
The 2 degrees centigrade is destructive and devastating for Africa.
And we go to India, where the findings of an inquiry on a mosque attack creates a political storm.
Their whole charge that it was a premeditated conspiracy is rubbish.
Those stories and more right after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The results from Massachusetts primaries to take Ted Kennedy's seat in the U.S. Senate are in. State Attorney General Martha Coakley won the Democratic nomination and could become the first female senator from the state.
They said that women don't have much luck in Massachusetts politics. And we believed that it was quite possible that that luck was about to change, and change it did tonight.
State Senator Scott Brown won the Republican nomination, but is not expected to contend in the Democratic-leaning state. The special election is scheduled for January 19th. The American Civil Liberties Union has lost one of its major funders and consequently could see a 25% drop in its national operations budget next year. The New York Times identifies the longtime donor as former hedge fund manager David Gelbaum, who was expected to donate $20 million. Another series of bombings in Iraq today after suicide attacks yesterday killed more than 125 people. Today's three explosions, one bomb hidden in a trash can and two others on small buses, killed seven civilians. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki addressed the Iraqi people today, urging calm. The government will go into special session Thursday to discuss the situation. That's the sound of foundation work on Israeli settlements in the West Bank from earlier this summer. This kind of startup work has ceased after a 10-month settlement freeze agreed to by the Israeli government, but thousands of settlement structures in the West Bank are still under active construction. In fact, a new report released today by the Israeli group Peace Now says there are currently more settlements being constructed per resident in the West Bank than in Israel itself. The group found that nearly 12 West Bank settlements are under construction for every 1,000 Israeli residents. In the rest of Israel, the number is approximately 8 per 1,000 people. Israeli residents are protesting the government's construction curbs in Jerusalem today. Meanwhile, in the Gaza Strip, Hamas authorities issued new orders restricting travel for residents. These restrictions expand upon Israeli-imposed travel limits that have accompanied their blockade of the region since June 2007. FSRN's Rami Almagari has the story.
The new Hamas rules require travelers to apply for permission 3 days in advance to cross border terminals controlled by Israel and Egypt. At the Palestinian side of the Israeli Eretz checkpoint, Hamas custom personnel began to turn down the travelers who don't have the correct paperwork. The sick in Gaza often use this checkpoint to access medical treatment in Israeli or West Bank hospitals. According to human rights groups in Gaza, the latest Hamas measure will further hamper movement of these patients. Samir Zakut is a spokesman for the Al Mizan Center for human rights in Gaza.
It is illogical to turn a medical patient down simply because they don't have permission from the Interior Ministry to cross the border. The measure constitutes a flagrant, clear, and unjustified violation of Palestinian law. It also violates human rights conventions.
But Hamas says the new requirements will provide more organization and will ultimately facilitate the movement of travelers. Rami Almagari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
On November 6th, activists all over the world began a hunger strike leading up to the UN climate meeting in Copenhagen. The organizers behind the Climate Justice Fast hail from Australia. They launched the worldwide movement in response to what they call watered-down climate legislation published by the Australian government. Now, over 30 days later, the country's Senate has defeated even that legislation, and the core group in the Australian capital, Canberra, is still on strike. Paul Connor is one of them.
I'm pretty much out of energy. It's very hard to walk around, and we just came home before, and the stairs were very difficult.
One of the protesters, 61-year-old Michael Morfitt, was hospitalized Tuesday after losing nearly a quarter of his body weight. Morfitt is eating again after doctors warned him he could die from the effects of the strike. Looking to Copenhagen, Paul Connor says without a commitment to 350 parts per million for atmospheric CO2 and sufficient financial support for the developing world, there won't be a solution to climate change and there won't be justice.
Unless we can get an adequate global deal, I think I'd probably agree that no deal is better than a weak deal. I mean, if you have a policy that's not dealing scientifically with the problem, then why have a policy? You know, it just tells people the wrong message.
The activists have committed to the hunger strike through the end of the climate conference. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. In Copenhagen today, the fallout continues after a leaked climate proposal from the Danish government emerged late Tuesday. The lead negotiator for the G77 plus China, a group of developing countries, called it a coup by rich nations that will produce an overly weak treaty. Critics say such a plan would not protect Africa, where climate change impacts could be the most devastating. But the text appears to be giving life to a serious push for stronger emissions reductions. From Copenhagen, FSRN's Jenny Johnson reports.
The head of the G77 plus China accused rich countries of trying to usurp the negotiation process by dividing developing countries and enticing them to accept weak reductions by offering fast-track financing. Stanislas Kaudi-Apeng-Lumumba of Sudan spoke today on behalf of so-called developing nations. He connected proposals from rich countries like those in the leaked draft to centuries of colonialism.
The empire has always relentlessly and ruthlessly grabbed natural resources. The new global resource is the atmospheric space. It is the carbon space. The Danish texts seek to secure 60% of the global atmospheric space to 20% of the world's wealthiest nations. It is a crumble and a rush of extraordinary magnitude.
Many scientists predict countries in the southern hemisphere will bear the largest burden of the impacts of climate change, even though they contributed little to the problem. Lumumba said the 2-degree centigrade target that largely serves as the basis for these talks should be abandoned. That level would mean a 3.5 degrees Celsius average rise in temperature for Africa.
The 2 degrees centigrade is destructive and devastating for Africa. The second thing, there's no scientific base for the 2 degrees Celsius. It is defined in accordance to a notion of feasibility. Feasibility asked for whom and at what cost is something that we need to ask.
Many are criticizing Lumumba, such as Andrew Light of the liberal think tank the Center for American Progress, who said the G77 head is, quote, working tirelessly to make sure there is absolutely no progress at the UN negotiations. The UN chief negotiator downplayed the significance of the Danish text, saying there are many draft texts circulating as a normal process of the negotiations. He also gave assurances that such draft texts are not part of the current process. Ivo de Boer.
All of those texts are now off the table. The contact groups are working. They've been instructed very clearly to work towards formal decision texts in a party-driven, transparent process that I hope will deliver the strong outcome on climate change that we're all looking for.
But the reaction to the Danish text seems to be highlighting the stance of many advocates here who say rich countries need to pay their climate debt to poorer countries. The World Wildlife Fund released a statement today signed by dozens of climate scientists that calls for a steeper greenhouse gas reduction target for rich countries in the near term. Stefan Singer of WWF Europe.
A statement which support the need for cutting 40% emissions by 2020 below 1990 is a key ask from developed nations. We have so far 65 top-level IPCC and other scientists to support that ask, to say it's absolutely needed that this ask from developed countries is part of the negotiation and is part of a final agreement.
The requirement is far beyond where countries are now. The EU Council will meet Thursday and Friday to decide the final reduction target they will offer next week in Copenhagen. WWF is urging them to move to a 30% reduction and use 40% as a bargaining tool. Jenny Johnson, FSRN, Copenhagen.
And now to get a closer look at some of the alternatives that are being proposed at the climate conference, we speak with Brian Edwards-Tiekert, environment reporter for KPFA. He's in Copenhagen right now. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Dorian.
This is the point in the talks where countries introduce new ideas. And as we just heard in the previous report, developing nations especially are making their voices heard. What are some of those ideas that you've been hearing about there?
I'd say some of the most aggressive and interesting ideas are coming out of some of the new left-wing democracies in Latin America. Ecuador, for instance, which has some very large oil reserves under some very pristine rainforest, has proposed that they keep that oil in the ground. They're the first country that's proposed actually taking oil reserves out of the equation. And in return, they're asking that the wealthier parts of the world pay them $3 billion to keep it there. Now, they haven't introduced that as a formal part of the talks yet. There's not really a good accounting mechanism for how much greenhouse gas emissions you save by keeping oil in the ground. The regulations tend to focus on what happens when you burn it. But they are trying to rally support for that preservation measure among an international audience here. We also have the Bolivian delegation, which is representing the government of Evo Morales. They've put two proposals on the table. One of them is to create rights for the planet and everything that lives on it. The second is to create an international court of justice for climate change. I got a chance to talk to the head of their delegation, Angelica Navarro.
We think that those that have created this crisis that we are now here to negotiate has to be liable for what they are responsible for. They have a historical responsibility and they have to compensate developing countries and the nature, Mother Earth, for what we are suffering and we will suffer.
Aid to developing nations is being negotiated as part of this process. Do you think a court is really a preferable forum?
Well, you see, it's 15 years that we are waiting, developing countries, for the implementation of the convention, and nothing has happened. Secondly, I just want to reframe your question. It's not aid, it's a debt.
As you can tell, the kind of language coming from countries like Bolivia stands in stark contrast to what was in the draft Danish text that you were reporting on earlier.
And experts say also some of the nations to be hit hardest are the low-lying island nations. Have you been hearing from their delegates?
Yes, I just finished interviewing a couple people who are here from Kiribati, which is on an atoll in the Pacific. It's about 90,000 people living there. The highest point in their nation is 6 feet above sea level. And pretty much everyone coming from those low-lying Pacific Island countries feels like almost nothing that's been put on the table in these talks or is being considered by any of the larger nations is aggressive enough to preserve the places they're living.
And what would they like to see? What are they asking for?
Well, they're asking that the nations gathered here at these negotiations commit to reductions of as much as 60% of their emissions in industrialized nations by the year 2020. Currently, what's on the table is somewhere between 20 and 30%. They're asking the world to try to cap its temperature increase at 1.5 degrees Celsius. And to give you an idea of how hard that would be, it's already risen 0.7 degrees Celsius. And scientists estimate that we've put enough gases into the air that are already cooking our planet that will warm another 0.7 degrees Celsius if we stop all our emissions today. That's the inertia of the climate system. So they're basically asking the world to slam on the brakes before the places they live disappear.
So these alternative plans that we've been talking about, either from Bolivia, Ecuador, or other countries, what kind of consideration will they get? Will they be introduced officially at some point?
Well, they get introduced during the low-level talks that are happening right now, which means they're brought to the table in various work groups that are broken out of the full session of the United Nations. Most of them will never make it to a point where they actually receive consideration before the full General Assembly. But what these countries are trying to do is change the conversation. This is a point that was made by the head of the Group of 77 Nations today, Lumumba Stanislaus Diaping. He said they don't have much hope for some of the governments that have been recalcitrant, like those of the United States, but they do have hope for the civil society in those countries. And they're hoping that the citizens of countries like the United States will hold their leaders to account and ask for more aggressive action on climate change.
We've been speaking with KPFA environment reporter Brian Edwards-Tiekert in Copenhagen about some of the alternative ideas being put forth at the climate conference. Thanks, Brian, for joining us.
Thank you, Dorian.
And to hear a longer conversation with reporter Brian Edwards-Tiekert in Copenhagen, including a conversation about the documents released earlier this week, go to fsrn.org. 17 years ago this week, a Hindu mob destroyed the ancient Muslim mosque Babri Masjid, located in the India state of Uttar Pradesh. The demolition led to some of the worst ever communal riots and claimed thousands of lives across India. A long-awaited report on the mosque riots was recently released and is causing a political firestorm in Parliament. Bismillah Galani has the story.
A parliamentary debate turns into a heated argument, finally ending in a scuffle between the MPs. The MPs yell and push each other violently to make their point. The altercation happened last month, after the Home Minister P. Chidambaram initiated discussion on the Liberhan Commission report. The commission was set up to probe the demolition of Babri Masjid, a 16th century Muslim mosque in Ayodhya town in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh. In the report, the top brass of the main opposition party, the Bharatiya Janata Party or BJP, are held responsible for the demolition. Manish Tiwari is spokesperson of the ruling Congress party.
What the Liberhan Commission in essence says is that it indicts those people who have breached the fundamental separation of the church from the state, which is the foundation of the Indian constitution. So therefore, it is a sweeping indictment of political parties who use religion to further their political ends.
But the BJP has squarely rejected the report. Prakash Javadekar is General Secretary of the party.
The report means nothing to anybody. We are rejecting in lock, stock and barrel because I have seen with my eyes how things happen. 1 million people gathered there to demonstrate, to protest and to do kar seva. But suddenly it started as a mob fury and nothing more than that. So nobody knew about it. Their whole charge that it was a premeditated conspiracy is rubbish.
The Babri Masjid site has been a flashpoint of tension between Hindus and Muslims for over a century. Hindu groups claim that Mughal Emperor Babur built the mosque on top of a Hindu temple, which was the birthplace of Lord Rama, one of the most important Hindu gods. The communal tension reached a peak in 1992, when Hindu groups led by BJP leaders launched a nationwide campaign to build a temple at the site. Hundreds of thousands of Hindus gathered in Ayodhya town, and on December 6th, a violent mob attacked the mosque, razing it to the ground within a few hours. Many in India view the event as a blot on the country's secular fabric. Senior journalist Veer Sanghvi witnessed the demolition and has long reported on the events.
It was a moment of national shame for all Hindus who were proud of our secular tradition and for all Indians. Groups of men in yellow bandanas going on, armed with pickaxes, armed with ropes, going about it quite surgically and bringing down the masjid. The UP police was guarding the site, presumably allowed all this to go on.
Soon after the demolition, communal riots broke out across the country, leaving more than 2,000 people dead and property worth billions destroyed. Most of the victims were Muslims. 70-year-old Hashim Ansari lost his wife and a son.
Those On December 2nd, around 200 people surrounded our homes. We sought help from the police and intelligence authorities, but they categorically said that they cannot help us. We were left at the mercy of the assailants, and finally, on December 6th, they started looting our houses, destroying them, and killing our people. 14 were killed in our locality.
The Liberation Commission was asked to investigate the events and to file a report within 3 months. But the panel took almost 17 years to complete its investigation. The outcome is still not satisfactory for many Muslims. Zafariab Jilani is coordinator of the Babri Masjid Action Committee.
We agree with the commission only to the extent that it was a well-planned conspiracy and BJP leadership was part of it. But we are surprised that the report totally exonerates the then Prime Minister and the central government, who we believe are equally responsible for the demolition because of their inaction. Had they behaved responsibly, the mosque would not have been demolished.
Muslim leaders are also outraged because the 900-page report does not recommend any punitive action against the people it finds guilty of conspiring to demolish the mosque. Instead, it suggests framing a new law criminalizing the misuse of religion for political gains. Following the uproar in Parliament, the discussion on the report has been postponed for now. But the government says it will bring up the report again in the current session. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
In Washington, D.C., Democratic senators announced they had reached a new agreement on health care reform. But to reach that agreement, lawmakers took out the public option. Senators also voted down new restrictions on abortion. Despite the forward progress, the path to 60 votes remains unclear. FSRN's Tanya Snyder reports.
In an attempt to move health care reform forward, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid had put 5 moderate and 5 progressive Democrats in a room and told them, essentially, not to come out until they had reached some kind of agreement. And they did, after 6 days of negotiations. Their agreement eliminates a publicly administered insurance option. The public option is part of the House bill and was included in one Senate committee bill. The Senate Finance Committee killed it, then Reid brought it back, and now his gang of 10 is killing it once again. Democratic Senator Kent Conrad says the public option is being replaced with something better.
That's a very big difference. Private, but not for profit. Largely so, that has universal coverage, that those systems produce much lower costs than ours, and healthcare outcomes at least as good as ours, and on many metrics better than ours.
The new proposal would create several national insurance policies that mirror the plans members of Congress are eligible for. Those plans will be negotiated by the Office of Personnel Management, the same office in charge of insurance plans for members of Congress and other federal employees. But they'll still be private plans administered by private companies. They're not exactly non-profit, as Senator Conrad implied, but they do put a cap on profits and even overhead. The senators mandate that 90 cents of every dollar a consumer pays for premiums would go straight to medical care. Michael Lighty of the California Nurses Association says that's a nice start.
The problem is, number one, they're not regulating premiums. So in order to maintain their profits, all the insurance companies have to do, of course, is raise their premiums, and that 10% of the dollar can still go to profits.
And if the Office of Personnel Management isn't able to negotiate an adequate plan, the government would then be allowed to come up with a public option, sort of like the trigger that was talked about back during the Finance Committee negotiations. But Lighty doesn't think it means much.
It's still a trigger, but it's so unlikely. I mean, yes, it's still there. It's really a ghost of its former self.
Then again, he says the public option had already been watered down through so many compromises that this final loss wasn't really so tragic. The Senate compromise expands Medicare by lowering the age at which seniors can enroll to 55. Republicans like Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee says the plan trades one new government program for 2 old government programs.
That would mean, in the case of Medicare, nearly doubling the number of people who might be in Medicare. At the same time, we're taking $1 trillion out of Medicare, cutting it out, And at the same time, the trustees are telling it it's about to go broke in 5 years.
The Senate also voted Tuesday to keep strong anti-abortion language out of the bill. The language mirrored the Stupak amendment that passed in the House. The amendment introduced by key moderate fence-sitter Ben Nelson, a Nebraska Democrat, would have prohibited people from buying insurance policies that cover abortion if they receive any federal subsidies. Nelson had promised to support a Republican filibuster of the bill if it didn't include his anti-abortion language. The Senate is waiting for the Congressional Budget Office to score the new proposal or put a dollar figure on it. But with progressives disappointed in the defeat of the public option, moderates disappointed in the defeat of the abortion amendment, and Republicans angry about the whole thing, the road to 60 votes could still be a long one. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
The U.S. government has reached an agreement on the largest settlement involving Native Americans in the history of the United States. The Department of the Interior will pay $3.4 billion to settle claims that they mismanaged American Indian trust funds dating back to 1887. Advocates for the settlement say it marks an important step, but that there is much more that needs to be done. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
The landmark settlement, announced by Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar, admits the U.S. government mismanaged Indian land trusts for more than 100 years. The case began during the Clinton administration and involves hundreds of thousands of trust funds owned by individual Native Americans. The agreement ends one of the largest and most complicated class action lawsuits ever brought against the United States. Lead attorney for the plaintiffs, Dennis Gingold, says the U.S. government has known for a long time that the funds had been mismanaged.
It's corruption, it is incompetence, it is negligence, and what it is in one short statement is an egregious breach of trust, which the U.S. Court of Appeals has stated repeatedly, and the U.S. District Court has repeatedly found.
The U.S. government controls 56 million acres of tribal land in the U.S., which they lease to industries for mining, oil and natural gas drilling, and livestock grazing. They are supposed to distribute the revenue from these leases to American Indians, but only a fraction of those payments have been made. Gingold represented the lead plaintiff, Eloise Cobell, a member of the Blackfoot Nation, along with 300,000 other American Indians.
We wanted to apply, we wanted the courts to apply, the law that applies to every other human being to Native Americans for the first time.
But despite enthusiasm for the agreement, advocates admit it is only one step. Native American communities remain worse off on jobs, crime, and education than the majority of Americans. Longstanding Bear Chief, also a member of the Blackfoot Nation, says the settlement doesn't repay American Indians for more than a century of mistreatment. He, like 300,000 others, will receive a check for $1,000 as a result of the settlement. But with unemployment high among American Indians, he says it's not enough.
That's laughable. She should have settled for jobs rather than, $1,000 apiece. Wow, that's a welfare check. I'm a single man, and I won't pay my bills for a month.
Congress must approve the settlement to make it final. Senator Byron Dorgan, head of the Indian Affairs Committee, released a statement on Tuesday applauding the agreement and promising a speedy approval process. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Today's headlines editor was Jess Burns. Washington, D.C. editor was Tanya Snyder. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Scott Pham and Antonio Ortiz. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.